Hello and welcome to the CAAV podcast. I'm your host, Alid Jones, and you're listening to episode 31. Today, we're talking about new environmental policies. In England, the major policy development has been the passage of the Environment Act. With a government committed to environmental improvement, this act is the master statute for policy in this area, entrenching the 25-year environment plan. There will now be a very large process of implementation with policy development, consultations, and secondary legislation to bring it all into effect. Here to talk about this and much more is Jeremy Moody, Secretary and Advisor to the CAAV. Jeremy, this is a government determined to leave the environment in a better state than where they started.
Yes, this is a government that has very clearly, very publicly, and repeatedly set out a goal that it intends to leave a better environment at the end of its term than the environment it inherited. And that is not just a new phenomenon of the present government. That has been a developing theme coming through from David Cameron and Theresa May's government, the government that did the 25-year environment plan. But now we're seeing the increasing force of the policies to deliver that. And I think everything that we're going to talk about this morning is entirely within that framework.
And central to the government's thinking is that nature underpins the economy and society as a whole.
Now, back in January, we had the Dasgupta report, which had been commissioned by the Treasury as an independent report looking at nature and its role in the economy and by extension in society. And that report, in 600 closely argued pages, set out how nature underpins the economy and society, that we have over the last few decades particularly been drawing down, if you like, from nature's bank, and that had supported higher growth rates and aspects of society that could no longer necessarily be sustained indefinitely. And so it was calling for nature's bank to be replenished as part of the long-run support for society as it confronts the challenges of climate change and biodiversity. And it's very interesting how the government is now yoking biodiversity so closely in its discussion of climate change. A lot about climate change can sound quite negative about its impact on people's lives, however important it is. A lot about biodiversity can be made to sound quite positive, that what is good for bees and orchids being good for people and good for the economy helps the government wind in a much more positive language for tackling that replenishment of nature's bank and so underpinning the economy and society.
And core to the delivery of the government's objectives is, of course, the Environment Act, which we're going to talk through now. And I guess it splits into two categories, Jeremy. You've got the high level elements and then you've got some of the specifics. Talk us through some of the high level components within the Act.
Yes, the Environment Act is to be seen as the master legislation for England across environmental policy. It pulls together and gives a framework for that programme of environmental improvement, and it includes some very high level and some very important measures, which as they're developed will have major consequences for the work that people do on the ground. So it looks high level, but it will have real world consequences for what comes through. We have replaced the role of the European Commission, which used to sue the government and take it to court over water quality and air quality and other issues. That has been replaced with an Office for Environmental Protection. That body has been appointed. It's got a chairman in Dame Glenys Stacey, and it's starting its work and already giving advice to the government. That is there to monitor government, is there to advise government on environmental policy and to look at environmental legislation. It's to monitor the development of the targets that we'll look at in a moment. And it has also got a role to receive complaints and to enforce environmental policies, indeed taking environmental reviews, like judicial reviews, to the courts against government. So this is a new creature of statute, but it is one with potentially a very significant role in driving the programme that the government has set in hand. We then have those targets, and these are now prescribed by law that the government will then have to come forward and lay them out and set out these as legally binding targets for such areas as air quality, as water quality, on waste, on resource efficiency, but also on soil health and its quality, and on species abundance. There'll be longer run targets, and there'll be intermediate targets, and the government is now in a position where it would be held to account for how it performs on those targets. So on water quality, that is a matter where it could again be taken to court, where it could again be pressed to improve policies if they're not currently delivering. And that's where these things will have real-world effects. Those targets are all to be consulted on and explored because they're not easy ones to set. And indeed, on soil health, the government is finding that a particularly difficult area and so resisted amendments requiring it to be more precise simply because we don't have the technical information yet on which to do it. The last part of this area concerns the definition of environmental principles. There are a number of internationally agreed principles expressed at the very high level that broadly come down to saying that you shouldn't do environmental damage, that if you do, you should remedy it. If you can't remedy it, you should try and deal with it as near as possible to where it started. The polluter should pay, and ultimately it could be offset or mitigated elsewhere. And these various principles that have been agreed at high-level international conferences now remain to be defined in English law. And that's important because for the last few decades, we've lived with the European law definitions of these, and a particular area of controversy has been the precautionary principle. And UK government after UK government has argued with Brussels that Brussels insists on looking at there being no risk whatsoever. And we argue that this should be assessed scientifically so that we look at where there are real risks and seek to mitigate them. And that now is a question that is very firmly in the lap of the UK government. We have had a consultation on environmental principles. The OEP, as a fledgling body, has advised on that, and we wait to see where the government will go on legislation. But that makes a pretty powerful background framework that will then come through in terms of what actually policies are that affect farms and estates and other businesses on the ground. That framework of international principles, that framework of legally binding targets, and then the OEP as the monitor and enforcer.
And that framework will clearly lead to a number of policies that can have a direct impact on landowners and farmers, as you've mentioned there, and in particularly around planning. Tell us a bit more about some of the local nature recovery strategies and plans of habitat that's likely to influence planning policy going forward.
Well, if we move from the very general to the more particular, I think we do so by way of the Act that requiring for England that it have an environmental improvement plan. And in turn, the 25-year environment plan that was issued in 2018 has been adopted as the first such plan, but that is then to be reviewed. That will then frame, again, all the policies to apply on the ground. The next step in planning, and this now is getting much nearer development control, is that the Environment Act provides for local nature recovery strategies. And these can be seen, as they appear in the Act, to look like local development plan policies, to be set at something like county level, to describe habitats, and through habitats, therefore species, that are to be treasured, where good things already exist, where good things should be improved, and therefore where policy effort should be directed. And those look to be quite potent when we come to consider the next steps in how all this works. But local nature recovery strategies, with their emphasis on habitats, could well influence where some of DEFRA's environmental land management schemes put their resources, particularly itself for local nature recovery, and note the overlap of the name, but also in terms of how biodiversity gain that we'll come to, the ability to use money from development uplift to improve habitats to more than counterbalance habitat loss caused by development, where that might be expected to go. So these local nature recovery strategies should at this stage be seen really as part of the local development planning framework, telling you where you are less likely to get development, telling you where you are more likely to be encouraged to improve habitats, and so support those goals of species abundance and the other objectives.
So sitting beneath all of this is the discussions around biodiversity net gain, and this is going to be an obligation on developers and landowners from certain developments. What do we know about the obligations that run alongside biodiversity net gain?
Well, at present, we only have the high-level legislation in the Act, and there's a lot more discussion and policy development and detail to follow. But what we know is that, in principle, all development is to achieve a 10% gain in biodiversity as measured using an official standard metric for the habitat that has been affected by the development. And that gain is at this stage to be a 10% improvement in the value of biodiversity. And this achieves something that had appeared very difficult, which is the monetization of biodiversity, of species abundance, or indeed of nature. And it's done not by focusing on species, but by focusing on the habitats that are likely over time and over area to deliver the species and the variety and the resilience of nature that is sought. This is something that is to be done in principle on site. And so that might see more generously designed developments, including nature in their design and aspects of how houses and so on are built. It can be done, though, off-site. And that is where we look at the agreements that people might have for biodiversity gain in terms of an agreement with a developer in which changed land management on land elsewhere, often nearby, very commonly in the same planning authority area, can be used to enable the development to proceed, but with compensating, more than compensating, habitat improvements elsewhere. In the background, the developer could, in the end, buy credits from the government in lieu of doing any of this. So there's a pot of money that can then be used for environmental improvements more generally. But those are likely to be priced at such a level to encourage biodiversity gain to be done on the ground directly by the developer or by agreement. That begins to become a powerful tool. With that need to deliver biodiversity gain, there is an extra call on the development and the uplift in development values. That competes with affordable housing, with community infrastructure levy, with the Section 106 commitments, and so on. That tends to deter development of higher biodiversity value sites. It also tends then to drive money towards improving biodiversity either on that site or elsewhere. So we now have what is potentially a significant economic mechanism for driving habitat improvement, tackling something that previously seemed very difficult to do in the marketplace. And that's simply one of the instances of how government is now using regulation to create value that then drives private markets in these areas, whether it be phosphates or nitrates or carbon, indeed here biodiversity, just as it has done on other occasions with things like milk quotas and the like. And this is where it gets very interesting, but we are in the very early days of such processes.
Yes, you mentioned we are in the early days. Do we know anything about where the biodiversity net gain must take place? For example, if the development takes place in a county, does the biodiversity gain also have to be achieved in that same area, same region? If there's a development in England, has the biodiversity gain got to be in England, or can it be anywhere in the UK? Do we know that level of detail yet?
We know something of this. We know the bias will be to keep it as locally as possible. If it can't be on site, they want it to be nearby. And in principle, that means either in the same local planning authority, so below county level in some cases, or in the same landscape character area. And that there are 169 different landscape character areas for England. So it keeps it within, it keeps it generally within England. It keeps it generally local. There are specific provisions for long linear works, if you like, HS2 or whatever it might be, but similar to that, where they're allowed to be in the proximity of the entire project rather than just in the immediate local area. But there is that powerful emphasis on proximity. The next step in this is that we have an advanced version of the metric that's to be used for calculating biodiversity gain. That biodiversity metric 3.0 was issued in July. We think it's not quite the final version that will be approved by the government for this work later next year, but it's thought to be pretty close to it. One feature of that is that in addition to the bias to proximity, is a weighting of the metric to favour biodiversity gain within areas approved by local nature recovery strategies. So you see these various tools of policy beginning to come together to drive a focus then on prompting habitat change where habitat change is most wanted. And that becomes, I think, again, that becomes something really significant interest for those landowners whose land is designated either in those areas and do or don't want to be, as well as those other landowners who had aspirations that might now be more difficult to fulfill.
And that's a really interesting point. For a landowner who has land that possibly was never suited for development, but suddenly if it's designated within a nature recovery plan or strategy, that might unlock economic value to the farmer from these biodiversity gain agreements.
Oh, this we think, and it is very early days, has the potential to unlock quite significant value that could be significantly in excess, in many cases, of anything that might ordinarily be available under DEFRA's environmental land management measures. This, with its requirement that land be locked up in these habitats for at least 30 years, and the commitment that that involves, and the obligations that it involves, nonetheless could offer payments that compensate landowners happily for that, and that could make some land that presently might appear economically marginal could now give it value for the way that society is now looking to value nature. There are interesting twists in this, in driving development away from higher biodiversity value sites. It potentially points it towards low biodiversity value greenfield land. A lot of brownfield land has higher biodiversity value. And equally, it probably tends to drive the modest improvement of other low biodiversity value land. And those are the things we will come to understand as we feel how this works in practice. But there is an underlying principle at the moment. We wait to see how well long it lasts, but an underlying principle that compensatory habitat should be provided on a like-for-like basis. So if it is grassland that is lost, it is grassland that should be replaced. If it is woodland that is lost, it is woodland that should be replaced. But I suspect that will prove harder in practice with the dynamics of the marketplace and the needs of continuing development than might currently be thought.
And when looking at the agreements, I know it's still very much early days, but do you envisage that landowners will receive an annual payment for some of these agreements, or will it be a lump sum style arrangement?
This is where the work is really to begin. We, as the CAV, have just published an introductory review of what might be the heads of terms for agreements, and that obviously touches on payment and payment management as much as on all the practical terms of an agreement about how it's to be delivered and protected and monitored and verified, and what happens if it goes wrong, and all of that. But in payment, we're driven by development. The developer is likely to want to pay a lump sum. The developer will simply want to move on to the next project. The developer isn't naturally a habitat manager. That lump sum, though, could come directly to a landowner under the deal, and then presumably be written off for tax purposes over the 30-year or more life of the agreement. It could be held in a fund with the responsible body required by what may well the probability that this is being done by a conservation covenant, and then released according to the delivery of the objectives of the agreement. There may be some need for upfront funding if there are capital works needed, if a water meadow requires sluices or whatever it might be, or indeed for woodland planting. There might be issues, again, around how you pay for the monitoring and verifying of what is done. All these need to be thought through, but what I think we start with is the defined pot of money that drove the agreement in the first place, derived from the development uplift, and that will have a ceiling because above a certain sum, the development becomes unviable, and again, set by what a landowner is willing to accept as warranting the change of use in all of this, in competition with all the other possible uses of land. So we have markets in which to feel our way before much of this will become any clearer.
And it will be interesting to see what impact conservation covenants might have on land values. If land is sold subject to an ongoing conservation covenant and obligations, will that have an impact on its value?
Well, the important thing about conservation covenants, and this is a new feature of English law. We've seen something slightly similar in Scottish law, and there's a version again in American law. But this now mirrors restrictive covenants that have allowed negative restrictions to run with title so that successors, people who inherit or buy land, remain bound, in that case by the restriction, could now remain bound by positive obligations for conservation purposes. So this is a new creature of the law, and it offers opportunities. There have been workarounds to try to deliver them in the past, but this offers a direct mechanism. The conservation covenants will have to be in place for 30 years. They will have to involve a responsible body, and the Secretary of State will maintain a list of those. Many of them are likely to be environmental charities, but it could include companies and even possibly water companies or others with their environmental objectives. So conservation covenants will be an integral part of the mechanism for biodiversity gain, where it is done off-site or indeed very, very close to the site as part of some form of land pooling by a landowner in conjunction with a developer. The value will lie in the obligations and the money available. So in that sense, it's not really any different from land subject to, say, a 30 or 40 year solar farm agreement. You're looking at what has happened to the land, and you're looking at the length of the commitment and the value of the payment. And so I think it's worth seeing it in that light, so that it unlocks that payment. It does carry the question of what happens at the end of the agreement and potential designation, which some landowners will not want and others may see as protecting the value they're now achieving. But the conservation covenant itself is simply a means to entrench that income flow, those obligations, and then for the market to find the value.
And of course, it's another component for the valuer to study in detail when undertaking a formal valuation of that property. And it's another aspect to consider. Now, moving on to another area which was subject to a significant amount of debate within the Environment Act between the House of Lords and House of Commons, and that's around stormwater overflows. What exactly was the issue there?
Underneath this is a serious issue that now is evident across the United Kingdom, in all parts of the United Kingdom, and indeed was evident while we were in the European Union, but is now gaining stronger force, which is around water quality. The quality of rivers, the quality of lakes, the quality indeed of coastal waters. And the concern here was around sewage overflows, where there are torrential storms. The sewage systems inherited from past decades and occasionally past centuries can't cope with the volume of water. The sewage systems often overwhelmed by development, testing their capacity. The increasing number of heavy rainstorms then surcharging the sewage systems where rainwater gets into the sewage, that then being discharged into rivers or out onto coastal waters, and the consequent pollution incidents and their effects on wildlife and the quality of streams and indeed drinking water and bathing water. And so with that background, the House of Lords, with the Duke of Wellington to the fore, pressed the government very, very hard for near absolute assurances. Indeed, they could be read to have been asking for absolute assurances that these surcharges would never happen again. The government sought to, had already made amendments to the bill to try and cover stormwater overflows, to bear on the water companies, to spend significant sums of money to reduce their incidence and manage it down. And the government here caught between the political pressure for absolute measures for cleaner water and the practicalities of the spending obligations and the contractual and construction work involved, was progressively pressed by the House of Lords, and it became the one final issue in the debates between the Commons and Lords, with the government now laying very firm obligations on the water companies to take very serious measures to counteract this. Obviously, we wait to see exactly how that operates in practice, but I think Ofwat and the water companies themselves will be under no illusions from that debate about the pressure that they're under. It then, of course, emphasises the issue that perhaps we can touch on later around farming and water quality, which again has become an increasingly policy-driven subject that we can look at that perhaps a bit later.
And are there any other provisions within the Environment Act you want to cover off in this podcast, Jeremy, including some of the powers it provides for over products from deforestation?
Yes, we've covered significant parts of the Environment Act, but by no means all of it. And there are many provisions. It's got discussions on waste, for example, and so the measures now being talked about for abolishing many single-use plastics. It's got provisions for the government to recall many motor vehicles on environmental grounds, and I think that's been little discussed, but I note that being there. It's got measures around felling licenses and land drainage rates. Again, we wait to see the full impact of those. Measures to increase protection for ancient woodland. That's woodland that's been there since 1600. And in terms of protecting woodland, it has also got a section and a schedule designed to control, restrict, prohibit, we wait to see, imports from land that's been deforested. And that might look like just the timber from deforestation, but the way it's now being discussed is that that could actually be a control on, for example, soya from disafforested areas of the Brazilian Amazon and Cerrado areas, or from parts of Indonesia with palm oil plantations in place of forest. That's an area that's probably going to be quite interesting to watch for how it interacts with livestock feed and indeed livestock products produced elsewhere from those feeds. That's going to be quite an interesting area where domestic policy interacts with trade, interacts with international obligations.
And what's the latest developments with environmental policies elsewhere in the UK? Because the Environment Act is England only. What's the discussions happening in the other devolved administrations?
Yes, it's important to note that while it sets a general tone, the measures in the Environment Act in the main apply only to England. There are some aspects we've not talked about that do go UK-wide. But similar pressures driven by climate change, driven by biodiversity, driven by concerns about air and water quality, from ammonia to phosphates, are biting across the United Kingdom. We have seen in Scotland the establishment of Environmental Standards Scotland, ESS, as a body parallel to the OEP to monitor the activities of the Scottish Government. We've seen the Scottish Government legislate to continue to accept European definitions of environmental principles. We have seen in Scottish planning policies echoes of biodiversity gain coming through in that. And then just dealing with the water question, we have seen a very fundamental step, I think, taken by the Scottish Government in its new water resources legislation for farming and water quality, where it has effectively imposed NVZ calculations and rules across Scotland. It has tightened very substantially the basis on which slurries and digestates can be spread, and it has imposed higher requirements for, with their capital cost, for the storage of slurry, of digestate, and of silage. And in doing that, it has, and this is where it moves, if you like, further down this road than the rest of the UK, it has removed the pre-1991 grandfather rights for slurry stores and silage clamps that had previously protected existing structures. Where those structures continue unaltered, they will have to meet some basic standards. As soon as any work is done on them, and it seems likely that the new storage requirements will require many to have work done on them, then they must meet the new standards. And I think the impact of that on a lot of Scottish livestock farms has yet really to be appreciated. In Wales, the water resources legislation of earlier this year remains in force, declaring all Wales an NVZ with parallel requirements on storage and calculations and spreading, but at the moment still protecting the grandfather rights that Scotland is just largely removing. Northern Ireland at the moment is seeing a wave of consultations coming through, much pending legislation after the next Assembly elections next May. And we have consultations out on an environment strategy. We have consultations had out on a peatland strategy, as well as the agricultural framework. And these areas, with a biodiversity framework to come, are all looking at how to carry forward environmental obligations in the province. Behind all of this, and again, it's how international commitments work through into domestic law, the UK government and the Scottish government have adopted a 30 by 30 declaration. And what that means is that 30% of the land area is to be used for nature by 2030. We have been given little understanding of what that might mean, other than setting a sense of direction. In England, it appears to mean, and I think in Scotland, it appears to mean at least declaring more land to be within national parks or areas of outstanding natural beauty. And we have had a couple of new AONBs and a couple of extended AONBs recently, and there's talk of more national parks. And Scotland's programme for government looks to declare at least one further new national park in all of this. What it means for land management, we don't know, but the Dimbleby report on food strategy makes the interesting, if perhaps very oversimple, observation that 20% of our land area produces just 3% of our calories. With all the new competing obligations and uses for land, with nature, with biodiversity, with climate change and carbon, with water management, alongside food, alongside forestry, alongside leisure, alongside development, then that is opening up the very interesting question of where markets and landowners' choices and public policies will seek to reshape the uses that we make of our land in this new environment. And that's the very interesting question for the next decade and more.
And are there any other air and water quality issues?
Yes, this is a very wide-ranging subject. For air, a major pressure across now many parts of the United Kingdom, particularly for livestock farmers, but also to an extent from fertilisers, is the question of ammonia. This has been an issue in Northern Ireland for some time, and this is now bearing down in air quality discussions in England and in Wales, and now beginning to be seen in Scotland. And the issue here is that from uncovered slurry stores, from manures, from some fertiliser applications, agriculture produces some 90% of the United Kingdom's ammonia released into the atmosphere. That has two effects. The first is that it deposits nitrogen on nearby imports of important scientific sites and damages them. But downwind, ammonia combines with other particles and other chemicals to produce very small particulates in the atmosphere that make air quality in cities very much worse. And particularly as London, during the pandemic lockdown, saw clean air for the first time in a very, very long time, this has become an area of much greater pressure. And so coinciding with the water quality pressures on slurry stores and the like, That similar measures help with reducing agriculture's contribution to ammonia. When we come to water, we've long had the nitrates directive, trying very hard through NVZs and other things to bear down on nitrates in water. What has very much come to the fore in just the last handful of years has been phosphates, again seen perhaps first in full force in Northern Ireland, but with the court decision in what's known as the Dutch N case, a very, very high hurdle has been set for development as where it could affect habitats downstream from the development. And this is to say that there must be scientific certainty that there will be no adverse effects on those habitats. And a crunch point in that discussion is around phosphates from housing, as indeed from farming and other matters, in that phosphate encourages very significant ecological changes downstream with the additional fertility it brings to the waters below. And we're seeing this now coming to bear in a whole range of rivers in southern England, in southern Wales, and some watercourses elsewhere. That is now frustrating perhaps 40,000 houses from being built in England, and local authorities who have been given a frightening message by the environmental bodies are still trying to find out how to deal with this. It's beginning to open up, again, that pattern that we've seen with biodiversity gain of mitigation on site, so remedying on site with packaged treatment plants where a housing development's big enough for that, but also off-site mitigation where, again, for sums that might be $5,000-$7,500 or so a house, money can be put into achieving phosphate offsetting elsewhere. The difficulty with this is that the woodland planting, the use of short rotation coppice, the abandonment of agricultural use of land, those are commitments that, like carbon, for carbon sequestration requiring a century, so phosphate mitigation, again, appears to require a century. And one of the things that's happening at the moment is now a growing understanding of how these arrangements might be made. Significant problems from some small developments at the moment, but this is, again, an area of work that is now beginning to crystallise with all its challenges, but now some possible solutions. Beyond that, the Environment Act also provides further powers for reducing abstraction licences without compensation as we get into the later years of this decade. And that's something that we'll just want to watch very carefully.
And on the theme of land use and targets and pledges, what's your take, Jeremy, on COP26? There was a lot of expectation in the run-up to the conference. Did it live up to that expectation?
I think it substantially did. It's international conferences like this are very difficult to judge. Governments have got their home audiences and their home treasuries and their home elections all to think about at the same time, as almost all governments know that they have to deal with climate change. The Chinese government, the Indonesian government, never mind the island states in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, often more than we are at risk to climate change and its effects. COP26 should be seen as part of a process. It's a framework for a lot of very grand declarations, but many more countries signed many more declarations, and it should be seen as a process next surfacing next year in Egypt, where those declarations are to be looked at with further expectation on plans to come forward. So declarations like the Global Methane Pledge, declarations around a more formal framework for international carbon trading, declarations like the one on pressure with $19 billion on deforestation, all those are gaining greater meaning. I don't think it was ever going to be an absolute moment of epiphany in which the world signed up to absolutely hard and binding things, but there was an increasing volume of commitment around both mitigation, so slowing the process of climate change and the issue of quite whether that delivers the full temperature constraint that is desired, and it doesn't as yet, but it's part of a process perhaps towards that, and also adaptation, because even if the temperature changed 1.5 degrees over pre-industrial levels, that is set as a goal, even if that is delivered, that is above where we are now, with the weather consequences, with the storms and the fires and the floods, with the shifting opportunities for vineyards, the movement of the maize line north, but the new pests, all of this, the pressure on how comfortable it is going to be to live in houses, those parts of the world where very high temperatures become enormous pressures on population. All these things have to be adapted to, as well as the underlying drift mitigated. So my take on COP26 is that it achieved quite a lot. It was never going to be an answer in itself, but it's part of a process that has now made significant steps. And in the UK, with the kind of domestic policies that we've been talking through, we have seen how those very high-level statements are translated into the kinds of policies that achieve change on the ground.
So in conclusion, Jeremy, having discussed an awful lot during this podcast episode and all the different policies that are likely to have an impact on landowners, how do they understand and identify the value in all of this?
That is an absolutely important question. Public policies can ask for whatever they want, but in the end, the choices about business, its operation, the way it uses land, are in the hands of individual landowners, of individual farmers, of estates and other businesses across the United Kingdom. The choices they make need to be well informed. The choices they make need to understand where value lies in this, where more value lies, where less value lies. It requires an open-mindedness about commitments. And that's sort of helpfully illustrated, I think, by that example I gave earlier around looking at a biodiversity gain agreement in the same light that you would look at a solar farm agreement. Similar length of commitment, possibly similar payment terms in some cases, possibly similar issues about after use. And owners are entering into those solar farm leases where they see that as satisfactory. They could enter into those biodiversity gain leases, agreements, whatever they might be, where they're satisfactory. They need to look at where opportunities, therefore, are really in this. And it could, for example, be that too much discussion has been seduced by the importance of dealing with carbon. And I would suggest that for most farms and most estates, the imperative of achieving as near net zero as you can, not just across the farming, but that's important, but across the whole operation, will require the farmer to do as much as is possible within the business before even thinking about trying to trade or meet anybody else's problems. The value of carbon at the moment in the private markets in these areas is quite low, and yet the importance of dealing with net zero on the farm is so great. So carbon perhaps is an area where people will want less to enter into agreements, though they may be required to make changes or meet standards for supply chain contracts and other matters. But the kinds of deal that might be available for biodiversity gain, for phosphate mitigation, sometimes for nitrate mitigation, those may offer significant opportunities for value that may in turn be genuinely attractive. But they also need to understand risk. If you put your land into a woodland scheme, that woodland will need to be used for business to attract business property relief for inheritance tax. It won't qualify for agricultural property relief. It will be bound under the Forestry Act to remain as woodland. So if felled, if you're allowed to fell it, then you would be required to replant it, or for carbon purposes, replant an equivalent area. Your biodiversity gain agreement could possibly result in a designation, which might in 30 years' time be a plus or a minus. It's understanding where value lies, opportunity is available, and what risks are in store. And that requires clear-sightedness. This is a gift horse to be looked in the mouth, its teeth to be closely inspected. These are important and significant deals to be struck or rejected, according to how they suit people and what they need to do. The underlying environmental imperatives are very strong, But in the end, it's for each owner to make their own decision, and in that a wider conversation, taking good, rounded advice on the prospects that are involved, how to maximise value, how to meet the family objectives as well as they can. These are all the critical challenges that are now coming to us at the start of this decade of decisive change.
And taking sound advice is a very important point to take from this podcast. And for CAV members listening, there are a number of briefing notes and guidance notes on the CAV website, including a very useful guidance paper on the heads of terms for biodiversity gain agreements. Well, Jeremy Moody, Secretary and Advisor to the CAV, thank you ever so much for joining this podcast. And there we are. We've reached the end of yet another episode of the CAAV podcast. If you want to keep up to date with all future episodes, or indeed catch up on previous ones, please head to our website, or you can subscribe for free on whichever platform you use. Also, if you've got any feedback or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch by sending us an email to inquire@caav.org.uk. But that's it for today. Until the next time, thank you very much for listening, and bye for now.